Poor old woman, said Retzia Warren Smith, waiting to cross the street. Oh, poor old creature. Suppose it was a wet night. Where did she sleep at night? And suppose someone passed, like one's father, or someone who had known one in better days. The thin sound of her singing rose up into the air like smoke, almost cheerfully. And if someone sees, what do they matter? Since she had been so unhappy, for weeks and weeks now, Retzia had given meanings to things that happened. Sometimes she almost felt that she must stop people in the street if they looked kind, to tell them, I am unhappy. And the words of this old woman singing in the street made her suddenly quite sure that everything was going to be all right. They were going to Sir William Bradshaw. She thought his name sounded nice. He would make Septimus better at once. So they crossed the street, Mr. and Mrs. Septimus Warren Smith. And was there anything to bring attention to them after all? Was there anything to make people think, here is a young man who carries in him the greatest message in the world, who is the happiest man in the world and the unhappiest? Perhaps they walked more slowly than other people. There was something uncertain in the man's walk. But what was more natural for an office worker, who has not been in the West End on a weekday at this time for years, than to keep looking around him, at the sky, at everything wonderful and strange? He looked like an office worker, but of the better educated sort. He wore brown boots, his hands were smooth, his face was intelligent, sensitive. He was one of those self-educated men who has borrowed books from libraries and read them in the evening after work. He had left home when he was still a boy because of his mother and because he could see no future for a poet in his country town. And so, telling only his little sister, he had gone to London, leaving a note behind him. London has swallowed up many millions of men called Smith, not caring about extraordinary first names like Septimus. He became shy and nervous, determined to improve himself, and fell in love with Miss Isabel Pole, who gave talks about Shakespeare. She lent him books, wrote him notes, and lit in him the kind of fire that burns only once in a lifetime, without heat. He thought her beautiful and wise. He dreamed of her, wrote poems to her, threw them away. He finished a great work at 3 o'clock in the morning and ran out to the streets. Mr. Brewer, his boss, knew that something was wrong. He thought highly of young Smith and expected that he would do well if he kept his health. So he advised him to play football and invited him to supper. Mr. Brewer was about to raise his salary when something interrupted his plans and took away his best young men. The war. Septimus was one of the first to sign up to the army. He went to France to fight for his country, to save an England which for him meant Shakespeare's plays and Miss Isabel Pole in a green dress. In the war, he gained what Mr. Brewer thought he was missing, strength and manliness. He was noticed by his officer, Evans. The two of them were always together, sharing, fighting, quarrelling with each other. But when Evans was killed in Italy, just before the end, in autumn 1918, Septimus congratulated himself for feeling very little. The war had taught him. It was wonderful. He had gone through the whole thing and had survived. When peace came, he was in Milan, staying in the house of an innkeeper with little tables outside, flowers in pots, and daughters making hats. He became engaged to Retzia, the younger daughter, one evening when, in terror, he realized that he could not feel. For now that it was all over, the peace agreement signed and the dead buried, he had these sudden moments of fear. He could not feel. As he looked into the room where the daughters sat making hats, he could see them, he could hear them, but he could not feel. He stayed among them, listening to their work, their laughter, and felt protected. But when he woke alone early in the morning, the bed was falling. He was falling. So he married Retzia, with her little artist's fingers.
"It's a lady's hat that matters most," she would say when they walked out together. She would examine every hat that passed. "Beautiful," she would whisper, making Septimus look too.
But beauty was behind glass to him. He could not taste. He could not feel. His brain was perfect. He could read. He could calculate. So it must be the fault of the world, then, that he could not feel. It might be possible, Septimus thought, looking at England from the train window after they had crossed the sea, that the world itself is without meaning. They rented rooms in a nice house off Tottenham Court Road, where Retzia sat at the table decorating hats for their landlady, Mrs. Filmer, and her friends.
"The English are so serious," she would say, putting her arms around Septimus.
At the office, Mr. Brewer was proud of him. Septimus had won medals. Retzia wanted to see London. Together they went to the Tower of London and to Buckingham Palace to stand in a crowd to see the King. And there were the smart English shops, hat shops, dress shops, shops with leather bags in the window where she would stand gazing. But what she wanted was children. 5 years of marriage passed. She must have a son like Septimus, she said. But nobody could be like Septimus, so gentle, so serious, so clever. Mrs. Filmer's daughter was expecting another baby. Retzia could not grow old and have no children. She was very lonely. She was very unhappy. She cried for the first time since they were married. Far away, he heard her crying, but he felt nothing. Each time she cried in this silent, hopeless way, he felt nothing. At last, he dropped his head on his hands, like an actor in a play, aware that it was not sincere. He gave up. Now other people must help him. Nothing could reach him. Retzia put him to bed and sent for Mrs. Filmer's family doctor. Dr. Holmes examined him. "There was nothing at all the matter," he said. "When he felt like that himself," Dr. Holmes said, "he took the day off and played golf, or he went to the theatre with his wife."
"Oh, what a relief! What a kind man," thought Retzia.
So there was nothing the matter, except for the crime of not feeling, for which human nature had found him guilty and would put him to death. He had not cared when Evans was killed. That was the worst. But he had committed other crimes too. He had married his wife without loving her. He had lied to her. He had offended Miss Isabel Pole. His punishment was death. Dr. Holmes came again and brushed it all aside. The headaches, sleeplessness, fears, dreams.
"Health is mostly in our own control," he said. "Septimus must put on weight, play a sport, take up a hobby. Dr. Holmes owed his own excellent health to his interest in old furniture," he said, looking in the mirror. When the fool came again, Septimus refused to see him.
"Did he indeed?"
said Dr. Holmes, and he had to give the charming Mrs. Smith a friendly push to get past her into her husband's bedroom.
"So you're in a bad mood,"
Dr. Holmes said, sitting down by his patient, who had actually talked to his wife of killing himself. Wasn't a husband responsible for protecting his wife? Wouldn't it be better to do something instead of lying in bed? For Dr. Holmes had 40 years' experience behind him, and he could promise Mr. Smith that there was nothing the matter with him. Next time he came, Dr. Holmes hoped to find Smith out of bed and not worrying his charming little wife. Human nature, that horrible creature, was coming after him with his blood-red nose. Dr. Holmes was after him. Holmes came every day. Their only chance was to escape without letting Holmes know. They could go to Italy or anywhere away from Dr. Holmes. But Rizzio did not understand him. Dr. Holmes was such a kind man who only wanted to help them. So everyone was against him. The whole world was shouting, "Kill yourself! Kill yourself for our sakes!" But why should he kill himself for their sakes? There were still pleasures, good food, the heat of the sun. And how would one do it? With a knife? With gas? He was too weak. He could hardly lift his hand. It was at that moment, Rizzio was out shopping, that Evans spoke to him. "Evans! Evans!" he cried. Then Rizzio came in with flowers she had bought from a poor man in the street, wild with terror because Septimus was talking to himself. She sent at once for Dr. Holmes, since her husband was mad and hardly knew her.
"You monster! You monster!"
cried Septimus, seeing human nature, that is, Dr. Holmes, entering the room.
"Now what's all this? Talking nonsense to frighten your wife?"
said Dr. Holmes kindly. He would give him something to make him sleep. And of course they may go to Harley Street, if they could afford it, and if they had no confidence in him, said Dr. Holmes, looking not quite so kind.